This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. The 1960s were a tumultuous time in the United States with the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, assassinations of major political and social leaders such as John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. It was a decade that reshaped the country forever. The world of sports was also being reshaped at the same time and in its own way helping reshape society. Author, journalist, and educator Samuel Friedman writes about it in his new book, Breaking the Line, the season in black college football that transformed the sport and changed the course of civil rights. He spoke with WVXU's Mark Haney.
Sam, set the stage for us. It's 1967. When it came to civil rights in college football, what were things like for the black student athlete at that time?
Well, this is a period when college football actually is one of the last pillars of segregation in the South. You know, an interesting and disheartening fact about college football at this time is that a lot of the big Southern schools like Alabama, University of Mississippi, LSU, Georgia, and so on, they had already been forced by the federal government to desegregate their student bodies. They'd done it begrudgingly and resistantly, but they'd had to do it. But they had very deliberately kept their football teams all white, the players and certainly the coaching staffs as well. And so the fact that a team like Alabama, let's say, could compete for the national championship, be on national TV a lot, be in the top 10, was really construed as one more proof of white supremacy. And so all the terrific black student athletes in the South were going to the HBCUs, to historically black colleges and universities. I mean, a handful did get recruited by some northern schools like Michigan State, but most were going to places like Grambling, Florida A&M, Tennessee State, Southern University, which had these exceptional programs and exceptional coaches, and yet were hardly on the media radar in this country. John Merritt, who'd been the coach at Tennessee State, had a great phrase, a bitter joke. He used to say that black college football was played, quote, behind God's back.
Hmm. And this was a case of the black colleges never played the white colleges at that time?
No, it was very rarely in a small college bowl game you'd get one of the black schools able to play an integrated team from the north or from the west. But no such game was ever allowed in the South. It was a feared prospect, in fact, in two ways. First, feared because there was really this belief that a black team couldn't be as good as a white team, a black coach couldn't be as good as a white coach. And, of course, if they went head-to-head, then you'd have an answer on the field. So you couldn't risk the answer you might get by letting the game occur. And secondly, there was this prevailing view, you know, on the part of segregationists, that blacks and whites really didn't want to mix anyway. You should keep them apart. And if you would actually have an integrated stadium with tens of thousands of spectators racially mixed, you'd be courting a race riot. So for those reasons, such a game wasn't allowed. And in fact, one of the stories that I tell in Breaking the Line is about how the coach of Florida A&M, Jake Gaither, spent literally decades building up the political capital with white politicians in Florida to finally win approval for an interracial football game to be able to be played in the South. That ends up happening in 1969 between Florida A&M and the University of Tampa. And it's a gigantic landmark in civil rights, not just in sports, but in the desegregation of public facilities.
Well, now, your book revolves around the Florida A&M coach Gaither. The team was quarterbacked by Ken Riley. It also involves Grambling coach Eddie Robinson and quarterback James Harris. And these were two black colleges in the South where the sport was still predominantly segregated. So how did each of these men play a role in eventually integrating the sport?
It's a great question. I mean, let me take Ken Riley first, because I think so many people in Cincinnati remember him from his really illustrious career with the Bengals. And in fact, he's going to get some honors this Sunday before the game against the Colts. Well, Ken Riley, I think, typified what Jake Gaither wanted to do in a gradual and indirect and subtle way for the movement, which was to use football scholarships as a way for young men to get college educations and to really send each of them out into the world as these living, breathing, walking, talking examples of the black case for racial equality. Ken Riley was the consummate student athlete at Florida A&M. Not only was he, up to this point, the best quarterback Florida A&M had ever had, but he also was the person with the highest grade point average on the team. And had he not gone into the pro draft for football, he would have been a candidate for a Rhodes Scholarship. And, you know, to this day, Ken will say that the thing he's most proud of in his life is that every member of his nuclear family has a master's degree. And by the way, Jake Gaither and all of his assistant coaches had master's degrees, most of which they'd earned at research universities in the North, because, of course, Southern universities wouldn't let them attend. So there was actually a real strong Florida A&M to Ohio State connection. Jake Gaither got his master's at Ohio State. So did several of his assistant coaches. And Woody Hayes, the legendary coach at Ohio State, was one of the people who'd come down to Florida A&M and help desegregate Tallahassee by going to coaching clinics Jake Gaither held. So that was another thing that Jake Gaither did, is when everything was rigidly segregated in Tallahassee. You know, this was a city that had bus boycotts and lunch counter sit-ins, protests at movie theaters because segregation was so widespread. Jake Gaither would hold a coaching clinic every summer and would get white coaches as well as black coaches to come down and study with him because he was such a master strategist. And the mere fact that they were there sitting together with Jake Gaither at the chalkboard was at least this momentary breaching of the wall of segregation. So that's very much, you know, the role that Ken Riley and Jake Gaither played, in addition to putting together the game against Tampa, which I had mentioned earlier. And then at Grambling with Eddie Robinson and James Harris, what you really have there is kind of the Jackie Robinson equivalent in pro football. Because on the one hand, there had been black players in the modern NFL as far back as the late 40s. In fact, the first one was also a Grambling player, a running back named Tank Younger. But the last position to be desegregated, and it was no accident, was quarterback. And the reason was totally tied up with bigoted attitudes about black Americans, period, not just in sports, in life. The idea was a black couldn't be smart enough to play quarterback. A black shouldn't be a leader, shouldn't be giving orders to anyone, certainly not to white people. Blacks were, quote, natural athletes, which meant they're sort of animalistic, but they wouldn't have the resolve, the grace under pressure that that being a quarterback requires. And so to create a black quarterback was really to take on some of these deeply, deeply held racist beliefs. And that's what Eddie Robinson and James Harris set out to do. It was a very deliberate plan that unfolded over years to develop James Harris to be the kind of classic drop-back quarterback that the pros, you know, always insisted that they needed at that time. And black quarterbacks who came to the pros were always forced to change positions on the excuse that they were, quote, natural athletes, that terrible double entendre. And so what Eddie Robinson and James Harris did together was set out to defy that. And they succeeded at it. In the years James Harris went on to have, particularly in the mid-70s with the L.A. Rams, were the years that opened the door for every black quarterback to follow. And, you know, James Harris was also, and Ken Riley as well, they're also part of the first wave of black coaches and black team executives in the NFL. Ken Riley coached on the Green Bay Packers. James Harris has been an executive on a number of teams. Now the Detroit Lions, helped build a Super Bowl team at the Baltimore Ravens in 2000. And so if you look at the Bengals coach, Marvin Lewis, and one of their assistant coaches, Hugh Jackson, you know, two African-Americans, who one is currently a head coach, Hugh Jackson had been one, you're looking at people who benefited also by some of the doors that were, you know, battered down by people like Ken Riley and James Harris, and also benefited from the example of Jake Gaither and Eddie Robinson, who were exceptional coaches and never got the chance to coach at a higher level. You know, as far back as the late 60s, the famous sports columnist Shirley Povich in the Washington Post was writing columns saying, why don't any of these NFL teams take a look at Jake Gaither? And Eddie Robinson, someone who knew him well, told me that he went through his whole career wondering why he never got offered the chance to coach LSU, you know, once desegregation occurred. So in a way, again, you have to look at Marvin Lewis as someone who's really the fulfillment of a lot of what Eddie Robinson and Jake Gaither struggled to achieve.
You know, it's interesting. Ken Riley was drafted by the Bengals' Paul Brown. Now, didn't Brown have a history of drafting black players?
Well, I think that actually, you know, Paul Brown was one of the more foresighted people in the NFL in terms of actually drafting players out of the black colleges. You know, overall, the AFL was quicker to recruit out of black colleges, and teams like the Oakland Raiders and Kansas City Chiefs led the way. But there were a few really ahead of their time executives in the NFL, Paul Brown, George Halas, the Bears, Vince Lombardi on the Packers, who also were really willing to go against the norms of the time. And in fact, interesting story involving Paul Brown when he was with the Cleveland Browns, even before the Bengals existed. One of his star players was a wide receiver named Dub Jones, who was from Ruston, Louisiana, which is the almost entirely white town right next to entirely black Grambling, Louisiana. Dub Jones was friends with Eddie Robinson. In fact, it was such a risky friendship to have that the Ku Klux Klan at one point paid a visit to the lumberyard that Dub Jones's family owned and said, "You got a lot of dry wood around here," as a message to tell them not to have that friendship with Eddie Robinson. But Dub Jones would actually tip off Dub Jones, who would tip off Paul Brown to players coming out of the black colleges who Paul Brown should be drafting. So they actually had quite a good track record on that by the NFL standards. But what is interesting here is that when you look at Ken Riley and James Harris coming out of college, you see sort of the two different destinies of African-American quarterbacks. James Harris had to battle mightily for his opportunity to play quarterback, and to hold on to it, he had to withstand hate mail and literally death threats and all kinds of efforts to bring in white quarterbacks to take his job away. Ken Riley was one of the many, many outstanding black quarterbacks coming out of college who never had the chance to play the position. Now, on the one hand, you look at the amazing career he had as a defensive back. He's still ranked fifth in NFL history in interceptions and really ought to be in the Hall of Fame. But you look at that and say, okay, it was a pretty wise decision to make him a cornerback. Look how well it ended up. But we'll never know the alternative. And when I look, you know, just at the Monday Night Football game this week, Russell Wilson of the Seattle Seahawks plays a very similar kind of game to the way Ken Riley played as quarterback, and a very similar, super intelligent, smart decision maker, someone who really plays, you know, with what's above his shoulders as much as any of his physical gifts. And I just think that looking at Russell Wilson is like looking at what might have been with Ken Riley, and what, you know, unfortunately we'll never know.
Yeah, you're correct. Ken Riley had a stellar career as a defensive back. Are you surprised that he's not in the Hall of Fame?
I'm totally surprised. And I've even, you know, written to that effect in the New York Times back in August. You know, I still hope it'll be correctable, because there is a senior players division which he would be eligible to be admitted under. I think what he has suffered from is being someone who doesn't promote himself. I mean, the thing that makes him such a really widely respected and admired person, tragically, because of the way our sort of sports media culture is, probably hurts him with the Hall of Fame voting, because he's never tried to call attention to himself. He's never, you know, been someone who showed off or who boasted, who played his own horn. His belief was always that your work will speak for itself. And as I say, he ranks fifth in NFL history in interceptions. There are people who rank well beneath him who've made it into the Hall. And the Bengals, during his 13 years with the team, had, I think, 8 or 9 winning seasons. They went to the Super Bowl. They're in the playoffs 5 times. So, you know, he contributed also to a team that was very successful. So it's not as if he was, you know, a star player on a crummy team. So I just hope that this can be rectified. You hate to think that the fact that he's not a braggart is going to be what's going to cost him the historical recognition he deserves.
Robinson, Gaither, Riley, Harris, are their legacies complete, or are they still evolving?
I think there's a two-part answer to that question. I think in the pros, you know, look, it's not a perfect world racially. Look at the Richie Incognito situation this year. But overall, if you look at the number of African-American quarterbacks in the NFL, at one point this season there were 9, the highest number in history. If you look at the number of African-American head coaches, including Marvin Lewis, this year I think it's 3, but some years it's been up as high as 6 or 7 out of 32 teams. You look at team executives, Ozzie Newsome, 2 Super Bowl rings as GM of the Baltimore Ravens. Jerry Reese, 2 Super Bowl rings as GM of the New York Giants. Martin Mayhew, rebuilding the Detroit Lions, and so on. You have to say that's a pretty good record, and it's a record that really says that a lot of, again, what Jake Gaither and Eddie Robinson struggled for is being fulfilled. Not perfectly fulfilled, but immense progress has been made. I think the colleges are another story, and I think in 2 ways. Number one, the percentage of African-American head coaches in college is only about 9%, and yet about half of BCS football school players are African-American. So there's a real lag there, and when you look at the success of black coaches in the NFL, you can't say that it's a lack of talented black coaching candidates out there. So that's one piece of unfinished business. And the other piece of unfinished business is that Eddie Robinson and Jake Gaither both emphasized getting your college degree, using an athletic scholarship in order to get an education. And their fear, even as they fought for desegregation, their worry was that when African-American athletes went to mostly white schools, particularly in the South, they weren't going to be looked at as the student part of student athletes. They'd just be looked at as the athlete who could be used up and left on the side of the road. And that's unfortunately been true in way too many cases. I mean, you can look at some exceptions around the country, Stanford, Notre Dame, interestingly Alabama, which have very, very strong graduation rates among their black student athletes. But in all too many cases, the rates are far below those of white student athletes, far below those of African-American students who aren't athletes. And, you know, to honor what Jake Gaither and Eddie Robinson were about, and to also, you know, develop people who would be the leaders, you know, and the people worthy of admiration like Ken Riley and James Harris, you have to take seriously at these colleges the education of black athletes.
Sam, you're in Cincinnati tonight for a panel discussion. Tell me about that.
This will be a great chance to hear from the people who lived the history of civil rights and sports, and particularly football. So I'll be moderating, and we'll have Ken Riley there to talk about his experiences. Also, Hugh Jackson, who's an assistant coach now on the Bengals and had been a head coach on the Raiders, and who, as I said before, is part of this really first generation of African-American head coaches to come to the NFL, and can talk about what the struggles in order to get into the coaching ranks. And C.G. Newsom, who's the executive director of the Underground Railroad Freedom Center. And what a lot of people may not know about him is he also was one of the first 2 African-American football players at Duke University. So he had the experience of going into what had been an entirely white football program until his arrival, and you know, being the pioneer. So it's going to be really fantastic for people to hear from the people who lived the history, what that history was about. And I think for younger people who don't know that history, it'll be a chance to learn it and to really sort of appreciate how much has been accomplished and you know, and what kind of struggle it took.
And that's 7:30 at the Freedom Center. And you can find links to more information at WVXU.org. Sam, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure. Always great to be on an NPR station if you're an author.
Thank you. Samuel Freedom is the author of Breaking the Line, the season in black college football that transformed the sport and changed the course of civil rights. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Mark Haney.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Rick Andrus. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.